For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning. I wanted to introduce our guest speaker. We're very honored and happy to have Kazuaki Tanahashi here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. He did a calligraphy seminar here yesterday, which some of you were at, and he's an internationally renowned artist and calligrapher who's done calligraphy workshops and had shows of his art in Europe and Asia and all through this country and in Latin America, and so it's very wonderful for us to have him here, and we have a painting donated by him in the front hall now. Thank you very much, Kaz. Kaz is also a very important Zen scholar, translator of Dogen, and also has written about other Zen works, but his translations of Dogen are very important for many of us, starting with Moon and a Dewdrop, Enlightenment Unfolds, and Beyond Thinking, translations from Dogen, Shobo Genzo, and other works. I had the honor to work with Kaz and help him with some of those a little bit. And just for everyone's information, there's a complete translation of Shobo Genzo that Kaz has done, which will be available from Shambhala in maybe a year, a little less. So that's a really wonderful thing for all American Zen students. Kaz is also a peace activist who has done quite a variety of peace work throughout this country. He was recently in Nanjing in China, and has been active in Costa Rica. I also wanted to say Kaz is an old friend of mine who 30 years ago I studied some Japanese, but took a haiku class with him at San Francisco Zen Center and started my own translation with Kaz. And so anyway, I'm very happy to have Kaz here to talk with us. Thank you, Kaz.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to join your practice in this wonderful new Zendo, doing this ancient practice of Zazen with all of you. Yeah, Taigen and I have been friends for a long time, and recently Dr. Layton was our scholarly editor for this Shobo Genzo book. And so we just kind of finished working on this glossary of the book. The book itself is about 1,400 pages, probably printed pages. Glossary, when I was writing, I thought I was writing a Buddhist dictionary.
Almost.
And 4,000 entries. So I'm sort of recovering from Dogen. King Ashoka lived over 2,200 years ago in India. He was the third king of the Maurya Empire, which was the first empire that united India. So his territory included the most part of current-day India and also Kashmir. And the founder of the empire, Chandragupta, there was a legend that he greeted Alexander the Great when he was a young man. And his father somehow, I think, his father sort of pushed back the Greek kingdom and then maybe got Kashmir back, I guess. And then after the death of Alexander, the Greek kingdoms are split into several Greek kingdoms that in like Syria and Olynthos and then Macedonia, which is the maybe original Alexander's kingdom. Yes, they had diplomatic ties. Ashoka's father asked the king of Syria to send some dried figs and a philosopher. And then in return, he sent a herd of elephants. So it's possible that Ashoka was trained by a Greek philosopher. I think it's very possible. There are two different Ashokas, you know, the same person, but he was known as a kind of an ideal kind of ruler. So he became a model of monarchs throughout East Asia for centuries and centuries. But Ashoka kind of legend was created over 400 years after his death. So it's a kind of Buddhist parables, Buddhist kind of dramatic stories that were created sort of to promote kind of Buddhist virtues, I guess. So this legendary Ashoka has almost nothing to do with the real Ashoka. But it was important because that was the only Ashoka known to most people until a British scholar called George Prinsep kind of read the scripts from the so-called Ashoka stupas and then kind of rock edicts. Ashoka built many stupas and then also had his edicts kind of carved on boulders in different parts of India and beyond. So now, thanks to the modern scholarship, we can actually listen to the real voice of Ashoka. And then we know that there's so much difference between the legendary Ashoka and real Ashoka. I guess you heard about legendary Ashoka. When in his former life, when he was a child, playing on the sand, he saw the Buddha and he was kind of awestruck. And he wanted to offer something to the Buddha, but he had nothing in his hands. So he offered sand. And then Buddha said, because of your dedication, you'll be reborn as a king, and you'll be a great king. You'll sort of do a great service to the world. So that's... and then he... the legend says that he became a great, kind of compassionate king, but... to make him sort of, he was converted to Buddhism. To make it more dramatic, kind of, he was a brutal king first. He was very ugly, and then he had this torture house, and then he tortured many people and killed many. And then there was a monk, Buddhist monk, who was captured and then tortured, but he was so serene. And then the head of the torture house reported Ashoka and said, something strange, you know, about this guy. And then Ashoka sort of saw him, and he was really impressed, and he was converted to Buddhism. And then he was so generous, and he set up pilgrimage sites. I think that's kind of historically true. And then he built, I think, 36,000 stupas all over India. And I think that's kind of exaggeration, but I think he built some stupas, that's true. And his life was miserable, I mean, later. His wife betrayed him, and then got him imprisoned, so he lost all his wealth and power. But he really wanted to kind of make offering to practicing community. All he had was a small fruit, half of the amala fruit. We translated that mango, but nowadays I think we learned that it's much smaller, you know, fruit. And so that makes the story more dramatic. Just he offered it to the sangha of monks and nuns, and then it was enough to satisfy all monks and nuns. So that's basically the story of Pali text Ashoka Avadana, and then Chinese Sanskrit text translated into Chinese called King Ashoka Sutra. Ashoka, one important part of Ashoka's kind of life is that the Buddha's dates actually are back counted from the coronation of King Ashoka. And that was known a long time ago. There are two kind of chronicles, you know. All of Buddhist chronicles in the Pali tradition, sort of transmitted to Sri Lanka, and then also another northern tradition from Sanskrit to Chinese. So in a way, it's important to kind of guess that the dates of the Buddha. And then recent scholars sort of discovered that there was a Greek record of erection of Ashoka Tower in Greece. And so it says, you know, this is some years after the coronation of Ashoka, this was built. So now, and then the Greek had this, what you call, absolute time system, like Christians. Buddhists had that too, but sort of forgotten, sort of exaggerated some part, and so it was not so useful. So I'd like to give you the dates of Ashoka's coronation. So it was 268 before the common era. So that's the only kind of date known in ancient India, you know. Because Indians are not like Chinese. Chinese were sort of obsessed with time and then individual names, and they recorded everything, you know. Indians are more interested in kind of universal kind of, you know, ideas and so forth. They didn't, they had, of course, you know, relative dates, you know, how many years from the coronation of this king and so forth. But they didn't have kind of absolute dates, so this is the only one date kind of, you know, of India, ancient India. So could be 269, but let's say it's scholars say this is the date, and then from the southern tradition, Buddha's parinirvana took place 218 years before that. And then Buddha kind of was known in through scriptures to have lived for 80 years, so we can kind of guess his birth date. In the northern tradition, it's sort of 118 years, a little bit maybe closer. Buddha's kind of parinirvana is closer to us. So it, a lot of Western scholars sort of favor the southern textual tradition, and then Japanese scholars favor the northern textual tradition. So, so the Alexander's eastern campaign took place about 60 years before the coronation of Ashoka. So we sort of had a little sense of the dates, mm-hmm. ancient dates. The, I think we have like a Mahayana Buddhist Sutra, like Parinirvana literature. It's about kind of the first century before the common era. But we know through the copies of manuscripts. Real manuscript, you know, Indian manuscript, the earliest I know is like a 6th century of common era, you know. Paramita literature, just fragments kind of are left. Because they were all written on palm leaves, and then they decompose, right? So we don't have, it's not like Chinese paper, which also decompose too, but lasts longer. All right. So I think one of the and then Ashoka actually, as a grandson of Chandragupta, he took power when he was 16, and then he was he ascended on throne 5 years later, and then a big event was a region called Kalinga kind of revolted. This is, if you kind of think of the map of India, the Ganges River kind of goes from the kind of central northern part and then central part and then go toward the east in general. So that's where kind of Brahman practice was kind of important. But also Buddhist, kind of Buddhism kind of immersed kind of along the Ganges River. And then close to the Bengal Bay is ancient kingdom of Magadha. That's where Buddha was born, and then he was enlightened and taught. He taught, actually he was born, excuse me, a little bit north. And now Kapilavastu is now in kind of, Nepal. But Magadha is close to Nepal. He taught mostly in the kingdom of Magadha. Like Vulture Peak is the city of Raja Griha. So that's, and then Calcutta, a little bit south. So that's kind of Buddha Belt. And then on the coast, kind of south to that, middle, about in the middle, there is a region of Kalinga. And then they wanted to be independent, you know. And then, of course, for a big empire, you know, if someone wants to be independent, it's a big threat. So he waged a kind of military campaign and killed so many people. It is said that Ashoka became a Buddhist in the year of his coronation. So, but he was not a complete and then good Buddhist at that time, you know. So he was still kind of a king waging war. But he saw the misery of the war, and he became so kind of saddened. So he, one of his edicts shows his kind of his really emotional voice. So I'd like to read that. He calls himself beloved of the gods, King Piyadasi. Piyadasi means joyful to look at. So, you know, King Handsome. So perhaps, you know, maybe he had to call himself. That means he was not so beautiful. The king conquered the Kalingas 8 years after his coronation. In this case, 8 years. 150,000 were deported, 100,000 were killed, and many more died from other causes. Indeed, the king is deeply pained by the killing, dying, and the deportation that took place when an unconquered country is conquered. But the king is pained even more by this, that Brahmins, ascetics, and householders of different religions who live in those countries and who are respectful to superiors, to mother and father, to elders, and who behave properly and have strong loyalty towards friends, acquaintances, companions, relatives, servants and employees, that they are injured, killed, or separated from their loved ones. Even those who are not affected by all this suffer when they see friends, acquaintances, companions, and relatives affected. These misfortunes befall all as a result of war, and this pains the king. After the Kalingas had been conquered, the king came to feel a strong inclination towards Dhamma, love for the Dhamma and for instruction in Dhamma. Now the king feels deep remorse for having conquered the Kalingas. So, this is it. His language is before, kind of, it's close to Magadhan, you know, dialect, I think. So, I suspect Buddha maybe was speaking language maybe closely related Magadhan's. And then it's Sanskrit is a kind of a common kind of literary language throughout India. You know, India has many independent languages, but Sanskrit is a common kind of language, formal language. And then the earlier form is called Prakrit, but maybe Ashoka's is even earlier than that. And then, so Dharma is, you know, he calls it Dhamma, like Pali, you know. So, it's amazing that, you know, we can hear the actual voice, so to speak, of remorse by this person who lived more than 2,200 years ago. So he kind of decided to stop any kind of violent aggression. And then actually he had 34 peaceful years of reign. I feel that he was the ancestor of a world without war. There's no evidence that he disarmed or abolished his mighty army. Probably he maintained it, but still, you know, he made a very strong kind of decision not to use military forces. He lived for 58 years, whereas Alexander lived for 33 years. So, what is his understanding of Dharma? So, this is the most meritorious work. This instruction in Dharma, for this purpose, this edict has been written. So, he was sort of telling people that they should follow the Dharma. That's maybe part of the reasons that he was kind of issuing these edicts over years and erecting stupas and carving edicts on the rocks. He had many queens and then many children, and then he had all the wealth in the world, so to speak. But it seems that he was not a happy person. He was always self-critical. He said, you know, I'm not good enough. But I think he used his self-criticism for the service of, the Dharma and the service to his people, I think. It is very difficult to do a benevolent act. It is easy to do ill. I'm never completely satisfied with my work of wakefulness or dispatch of business. There is no other work more important than doing what is good for the well-being of all people. This indeed is most difficult to achieve, save by utmost exertion. It is very difficult to gain happiness in this world and in the next, except by utmost devotion to Dhamma, utmost examination, utmost devoted service, utmost fear of sin, and utmost enthusiasm. There is no gift like the gift of Dhamma, no acquaintance like acquaintance with Dhamma, no distribution like distribution of Dhamma, and no kinship like kinship through Dhamma. And it consists of this: proper behavior towards servants and employees, respect for mother and father, generosity to friends, companions, relations, Brahmins, and ascetics, and not killing living beings. And at that time, in the kind of dominant religion of India, Brahmanism, in the ancient, came from ancient Vedic practice, kind of rituals are most important in their religious lives. So the priest, Brahmins, are kind of a key people in this religion. And then animal sacrifice was always kind of taking place with different kind of rituals. And Ashoka, as a king, he banned the animal sacrifice, which actually forever changed kind of practices. The king has called this Dhamma edict to be written here: in my domain, no living beings are to be slaughtered or offered in sacrifice. Nor should festivals be felt, for the king sees much to object to in such festivals, although there are some festivals that the king does approve of. And then also Ashoka was very responsible for kind of spreading vegetarianism. As you know, maybe India is one of the countries where there's such a high proportion of vegetarians. Formerly in the kitchen of the king, hundreds of thousands of animals were killed every day to make curry. But now, with the writings of this Dhamma edict, only three creatures, two peacocks and a deer, are killed. And the deer, not always. And in time, not even these three creatures will be killed. So he started this practice first in his court. One of, I think, Ashoka's kind of characteristics was that tolerance to other religions. He was a Buddhist, but he respected Brahmins, and also he sent donations to practitioners of different beliefs. You are true to your own beliefs. If you accord kindly treatment to adherents of other faiths, you harm your own religion by harassing followers of other creeds. The one root of essential growth of the increase of spiritual strength is a guarding of one's speech so as to avoid the extolling of one's own religion to the decrying of the religion of another, or speaking lightly of it without occasion or relevance. Please excuse the colonial English, but anyway, this is not my translation. So. Acting in a contrary manner, one injures one's own religion and also does disservice to the religions of others. One who relevances one's own religion and disparages that of another from devotion to one's own religion and to glorify it over all other religions does injure one's own religion more certainly. So, you know, can you believe this is the kind of person, you know, who lived over 2,000 years ago? So, in a way, Ashoka single-handedly sort of made Buddhism kind of a pan-Indian religion, you know. It was maybe Buddhism until that time was a local religion in this kind of northeastern part of India around that time, around that area. It was sort of limited. He moved his capital from Patna, so that area, to Mathura. So it's a central kind of India. So you can see, can you think of kind of his counterpart in Europe, in Christianity? Constantine the First, Constantine the Great. He lived over 500 years after Ashoka. He saw, kind of, when he was young, persecution of Christians in Rome, in the Empire of Rome, and then he became an emperor, but somehow, you know, there was east and western part of Rome, and then kind of eastern part didn't approve him or something like that, and he didn't have a full power. So he had to wage war, it's called the Melbourne Bridge War. That was a kind of very symbolic war, and this is near Rome, the city of Rome. And then he believed that Christian God helped him. So he became a Christian. And it's a wrong reason to be a Christian. And then, you know, he sort of, he wanted everyone else to be Christians. And, you know, in his time of ruling for 25 years, he kind of fought. He invented the crusade. Of course, before that, Christians didn't have a nation and didn't have military forces. So he was the one, first one, he kind of waged war against pagans in the in the East, and then eventually he moved the capital from Rome to Byzantine. Now it's, and then later called Constantinople, now Istanbul, yeah. So he was kind of, you know, just kind of, whole his mission, life's mission was to wipe out pagan beliefs, which was dominant, of course, you know, religion before him. So he single-handedly actually built the a Christian kingdom, which lasted for a long, long time, you can see. So you can see kind of the his approach with Ashoka's approach. And in a way, I think he was also the ancestor of engaged Buddhism, kind of, you know, applying this principle of Dharma to change social systems and to do service to our people. He built hospitals for humans and also for animals. Everywhere within the king's domain and among the people beyond the borders, has the king made provision for two types of medical treatment: medical treatment for humans and medical treatment for animals.
So did he have universal health care for all the people in
including animals? Medical herbs suitable for humans and animals are not available. Wherever medical roots or fruits are not available, I have had them imported and grown. Along the roads, I have had wells dug and trees planted for the benefit of humans and animals. And then he was saying that, and then he built highways, and then rest houses, you know, where people can stay. And he said, this is a neutral area. Even enemies can kind of stay together in this rest house. They are not allowed to fight. Mm-hmm. So in a way, he was kind of inventor of neutral zones, you know, international neutral zones. It is most desirable that there should be absolute equality for all in legal proceedings and in the punishment awarded. In the past, kings used to go out on pleasure tours during which there was hunting and then other entertainment. But 10 years after the king had been coronated, he went on a tour to somebody and thus instituted Dharma tours. So it's like a pilgrimage. During these tours, the following things took place: visits and gifts to Brahmins and ascetics, visits and gifts of gold to the aged, visits to people in the countryside, instructing them in Dharma, and discussing Dharma with them as is suitable. It is this that delights the king, and is, as it were, another type of revenue. And then I think I'll be speaking briefly, finally. And then I think So he sent, in a way, in his mind, missionaries to Greek kingdoms, and then sort of encouraged kings to practice Dharma. And he feels that it worked, so he calls it Vijaya, that means victory. And I think this translates as conquest of Dharma, but I don't think conquest is right word. I think Vijaya is victory, but I think maybe we can push it like embracement with Dharma. You know, I would like to, you know, instead of victory with Dharma. You know, but he was a king, so maybe victory is maybe more comfortable language for him. But anyway, he talks about sending envoys. But these envoys are sort of missionaries. So now, I just read it as it is. Now it is conquest by Dharma that the king considers to be the best conquest. And the conquest by Dharma has been won here on the borders, even 600 yojanas away, where the Greek king Antiochus ruled, beyond there, where the four kings named Ptolemy, Antigonus, Magas, and then Alexander rule. Likewise, in the south, among the Colas, the Pandias, and as far as Tenaparni. I think it refers to Burma and then Sri Lanka and regions like that. Yeah. Here in the king's domain, among the Greeks, the Cambodians, the Navakas, and Napankis, and then Bohas, and then Britannicas, everywhere, people are following the king's instructions in Dharma. Even where the king's envoy have not been, these people too, having heard of the practice of Dharma and the ordinance and instructions in Dharma given by the king, are following it and will continue to do so. This conquest has been won everywhere and it gives great joy, the joy which only conquest by Dharma can give. But even this joy is of little consequences. The king considers the great fruit to be experienced in the next world to be more important. So I think this is also, I think when he visited the Buddhist community, he calls himself the king of Magadha. And, because it's a Magadha is a kind of Buddhist country. And then he encouraged monks and nuns and lay people to study various texts. You should read this text, this is important, and so forth. It's a kind of strength the king is telling, you know, Dharma practitioners. But I guess maybe he had the best maybe advisor, you know. Say, okay, this should be the kind of nationally approved Buddhist text, something like that. So, thank you so much. And if you have any thoughts, questions?
So, thank you, Kaz. Yeah, we have this rare opportunity to have Kaz here, so if anyone has questions or responses, please feel free.
Do we know what the texts were that he was recommending, or was there a course of study?
Yeah.
What kind of training did the emissaries that he sent about have?
Well, he was actually, you know, one of the edicts talks about the text, and some is a part of Dhammapada. Now this, but Dhammapada was probably put together later, you know, so it was more like fragmental in his time. Yeah, this is coming. Okay. Yeah. These Dharma texts, extracts from the disciplines. I think it's precepts. You know? The noble way of life, the fears to come. This is a different text, I guess. The poem on the silent sage. I think this is in Sutta Nipata. The discourse on the pure life. Upasita's questions. And then the advice to Rahula, you know, that's Buddha's son, who became a monk, which was spoken by the Buddha concerning false speech. So, yeah, these are the ones. Yeah.
As you were talking, I was thinking about how many aspects of his story are such a wonderful example for all of us, that as a child in a past life, he made an offering and it was predicted that he would become a king, you know, not a Buddha. He was predicted to become a king. And I was thinking when you were saying that, you know, we all have our own individual station in life and can bring, you know, some combination, as maybe he did, of the possibility for enlightenment along with our kind of, you know, limited, foolish human delusion. And he had you showed so many good examples of that, of, you know, how he was this sort of horrible king, whatever, you know, kind of a warrior king who, you know, was able to wake up a little bit and bring some more compassion, and not entirely through his own efforts, but partly because he was just in the place that he was and something came and, you know, woke him up a little bit. And I was just so touched by what a give and take, you know, was involved. It wasn't all he was so, you know, brilliant and enlightened. It was like he had this combination, and enlightenment could work its way out through him. And then he was in a position to, you know, recommend that people read these books, which, you know, nobody else would have, you know, if he had been, you know, just whatever, a carpenter or a rice miller, people might not have listened to him the same way. So I was just really, really struck by that. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So, I know, I think we should really separate this legendary Ashoka and then also the real Ashoka. But I think, you know, kind of dramatic kind of fiction is more compelling and more inspiring. That's true too. That's how I think a lot of stories of even Buddhas were kind of developed over time, you know. And, and then we don't have any kind of portrait of Ashoka because, you know, his time there was not kind of no images, you know, no Buddhist images. Mm-hmm. And then it was pre-Mahayana time. So this kind of, the notion of bodhisattvas, you know, was pretty early, soon after the death of Buddha. I guess Buddha was a great person, so he must have done something wonderful in his earlier time. So that is the kind of notion of bodhisattva, one who seeks enlightenment. So Buddha's early kind of stories of his kind of former lives. But then the notion of bodhisattvas we talk about, kind of the one who embodies enlightenment, or encourage, lead other people to enlightenment, that kind of with determination, taking actions for the benefit of others. This kind of bodhisattva ideal came with this kind of rise of Mahayana Buddhism, which actually happened, at least the Mahayana Buddhist literature emerged, began to emerge in the first century before the Common Era. So, you know, in a way, he was a pre-bodhisattva figure.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, no one has, and then I don't think I can prove, but I guess that he was maybe one of the kind of prototype of bodhisattva, you know, image. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
The real Ashoka, was he just a Buddha believer in Buddhism, or a friend to Buddhism, or is it known if he was, if he actually had like a sincere meditation practice, if he was a practitioner as well?
Yeah, I think he was saying that, okay, there are two types of things. One is to follow the discipline, you know, disciplinary. I think it means following the precepts. And then another is meditation practice. And he said meditation practice is far more important than disciplinary practice. He was saying in his edict. So in a way, he was a kind of also kind of early lay meditator. You know?
Because you're talking about the real and the legendary Ashoka, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. still the edicts you read, mm-hmm. Which describe nonviolence and spreading Dharma, mm-hmm. that's the real Ashoka, right? That's what we know.
This was carved in his time.
Yeah.
And that is a historic, you know, Ashoka. Maybe that's the only kind of, these carved edicts are the only evidence of Ashoka's kind of own, you know, thinkings and ruling, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many of those stones are left, the stupas and the stones?
Many. I think there's one, you know, Ashoka Tower in Salamat, in the museum, you know, where Buddha first gave, turned the wheel of Dharma. I forgot, but there are many, actually. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Well, there will be a chance for people to talk informally with Kaz afterwards, so maybe we're running a little longer than usual. So let's close with our four bodhisattva vows, and then
Can I just say?
Yes, please.
You could Google Ashoka. Ashoka edicts, and then all the edicts are actually, you know, found. And then all the information, you know, about his edicts from it.
Yeah. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.